Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. We do have a full court. The court has convened en banc this morning to hear oral argument in Texas Department of Public Safety versus Frank Riley Gilfeather. We understand counsel in that case have both announced ready and declared the time that they wish to take for their argument. So we'll now call the case.
May it please the court. Before I begin, I'd first like to thank you for this rare opportunity. And now I'll begin. In 1993, this court stated in the case of Lee versus State, which is found at 866 Southwest 2nd, page 298, that a consciousness of guilt may be one of the strongest indicators of guilt. It is consequently a well-accepted principle that any conduct on the part of a person accused of a crime subsequent to its commission, which indicates a consciousness of guilt, may be received as a circumstance tending to prove that he committed the act with which he is charged. It's a principle that this court has revisited on several occasions. It's a principle that this court should revisit when it addresses this case on rehearing. The actions of the defendant in this case indicate a consciousness of guilt. By refusing to participate in field sobriety tests, the defendant attempted to hide his insobriety.
So invoking a constitutional right to remain silent is evidence of guilt?
The constitutional right to remain silent applies only to testimonial.
Well, I'm asking you, is invoking the constitutional right to remain silent evidence of guilt?
I don't believe so, no.
Is invoking the constitutional right to advice of counsel evidence of guilt?
No.
Is invoking the constitutional right to terminate an interview evidence of guilt?
No.
Is invocation of the Texas constitutional right not to be compelled to give evidence, provide evidence against yourself, evidence of guilt?
No.
All right, thank you.
All of these points are true. However, none of those points apply to the conduct that we have in this case. The failure to provide field sobriety tests, the failure to take field sobriety tests, does not fit under any of those guidelines. Even Section 10 of the Texas Constitution, which states that a person shall not be required to provide evidence against themselves, only applies to testimonial evidence. And that's laid down by the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Olson case. And the Olson case was a case which was talking about having a person provide a handwriting sample. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said, yes, you do have to provide a handwriting sample, even though that would, in some people's opinions, fall under the guise of providing evidence against yourself. Because it was not testimonial evidence, the Court of Criminal Appeals said, no, that is permissible. And the Court of Criminal Appeals specifically stated, again, in Gassaway, that field sobriety tests, as long as they do not require a defendant to provide some sort of belief or some sort of knowledge, are not testimonial in nature, and therefore it is permissible to require the defendant to do those field sobriety tests.
Wait, who said it's required?
In Gassaway, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that the officers can require the defendant to perform field sobriety tests. As long as they do not require the defendant to give some sort of testimonial as to anything that he believes or any
Didn't
personal
Didn't you just
knowledge.
Say Gassaway had to do with writing examples?
That's Olson.
Oh, Olson, sorry.
Olson has to do with writing samples. And Olson is the case where the Court of Criminal Appeals specifically said that even though the language of Section 10 says give evidence, what it means is to provide testimony, because it was codifying the common law. is the way that the Court of Criminal Appeals phrased that. And so based on that, based on the holdings of the Court of Criminal Appeals, we can see that requiring a defendant to provide field sobriety tests does not violate any of his constitutionally protected rights. Therefore, if the defendant is not invoking any of his constitutionally protected rights, his failure to participate in the field sobriety test can be held against him. And this is not a case where we've got equally plausible but opposite inferences either. Because, first of all, that standard has no application in a substantial evidence review case. And the Waco Court of Appeals in the Department of Public Safety versus Hirschman pointed that out. Hirschman is a case that this court has cited in the past. And the reason why that is because in order to have equally plausible inferences, you must, by definition, weigh the impact of those inferences. And if you are weighing the impact of those inferences, then you are stepping into a position that is reserved specifically for the ALJ. So the equally plausible but opposite inferences has no application in a substantial evidence standard of review case, such as the one that we have here today.
Is there any function at all to the hearing before a trial judge as opposed to the ALJ?
The hearing before the trial judge is to make sure that there were no errors of law committed by the ALJ. And also to, in the sense that there, if there is no evidence at all, then the trial judge can overturn the ALJ if there's less than a scintilla of evidence. And so those are the two. It's a very, very limited scope of appeal before the trial court. But that is the function of the appeal before the trial court, is to make sure that there were no errors of law and to make sure that there is at least a scintilla of evidence. In this case, there's definitely more than a scintilla of evidence, as we pointed out in our motion for a hearing. Particularly, I would point out the officer's opinion that the defendant was intoxicated, which the Court of Criminal Appeals has held that an officer's opinion can be sufficient evidence in a criminal case to show that the defendant was actually intoxicated. And I would remind the court that in this case, we're not actually trying to prove that he was intoxicated. We're only trying to prove that there was probable cause to believe that he was intoxicated. Probable cause being a much lesser standard, not even a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant was intoxicated. And I would say that this is not a case where the officer is basing a subjective opinion on no facts at all. There are facts in the record on which the officer could base this belief reasonably. The defendant swayed as he stood, he swayed as he walked, he had bloodshot, glassy eyes, and he had an odor of alcohol coming not only from his breath, but also from his person. These are four indicators that the Court of Criminal Appeals has recognized as signs of intoxication. You take all those signs of intoxication, you add them to the fact that the defendant tried to conceal his intoxication by refusing field sobriety tests, and there is definitely probable cause to believe that he was intoxicated.
And what do we do if the videotape contradicts the statements of the police officer?
If the videotape is conclusive,
do we have to take as true the testimony of a police officer if it's not supported by the videotape?
If the videotape is conclusive, and again, there are certain things that the videotape is not going to show. For example, the videotape is not going to show whether or not there was an odor of alcohol coming from the defendant. The videotape is not going to show whether or not the defendant's eyes jerked during an HGN test. And the videotape is going to have certainly a limited ability to show any sway that the defendant has, because you take a 6-foot individual and you reduce him down to 6 inches high on a TV monitor, and that one or 2 inches of sway that the officer sees when he's standing there with him in the field is going to be minuscule on the videotape. But if there is, in fact, video evidence that completely and positively refutes what the officer testified to, then that has been found that the court can look at that videotape and reject the testimony of the officer. In this case, we don't have a videotape that refutes the officer's evidence. So although it can happen, it doesn't apply to this case. The other point that I'd like to bring out is that this court has itself in the past relied on the fact that the defendant's refusal to provide field sobriety tests is a factor that can be considered when determining whether or not there was probable cause for an arrest. And this has happened on many occasions, and I think that the court's failure to do it in this case, I hope, was perhaps an oversight, but I think that it's something that strongly needs to be considered when you're looking back at prior precedents and you take a case that is very similar in many ways to others, and you say that we're not going to count it in this case, but we are going to count it in these other cases. There needs to be some rationale, some reason why. And I don't believe that the court's opinion in this case was substantial to provide that definition between the cases, that distinction between the cases.
Question. In your opinion, is a factor equivalent to evidence?
I believe it is, yes. It's some evidence tending to prove that the defendant committed the crime. Now, it may not stand on its own, but when you look at the totality of the circumstances, when you combine it with other factors, other evidence, then it does amount to probable cause. And so when we talk about factors, we are talking about evidence, yes.
But we're not talking about guilt-innocence, a guilt-innocence determination. We're only talking about a probable cause review.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's another important point to make when we're talking about the equally plausible but opposite inferences. That language came from, in Hirschman, what they talked about, citing it back to, was the Walmart stores versus Gonzalez. And Walmart versus Gonzalez cites back to Litton Industries products versus Gamage. Walmart stores versus Gonzalez was a slip and fall case, and the circumstantial evidence in that case was that there was dirt on the macaroni and cheese that the defendant or that the plaintiff slipped on, and so they were trying to impute constructive knowledge based on the fact that there was dirt on the macaroni and cheese that Walmart knew that this was there. And so they had just this circumstantial evidence that the dirt was on there, trying to prove an ultimate fact, which was that Walmart had constructive knowledge that the that the macaroni and cheese was on the floor. And so in this case, we're not talking about one piece of circumstantial evidence. We're talking about many pieces of evidence that all point to not a constructive fact, not an actual fact, but a belief. A reasonable belief on the part of the officer that the defendant was driving while intoxicated. And that's the standard.
So anytime somebody refuses to participate in the field sobriety test, which I have never seen anybody pass, even police officers, that's evidence of guilt. That is sufficient to provide probable cause to arrest. Not reasonable suspicion, but probable cause.
By itself, no. But with other factors, yes. And in this case, there are other factors. There's the odor of alcohol on his breath. There's the odor of alcohol on his person. There are the red, bloodshot, glassy eyes. There is the swaying while he's standing and the swaying while he's walking.
And the fact that he said his dad told him never, ever to participate in field sobriety tests.
Your Honor, there can be innocent reasons for destroying evidence in a murder trial.
That's not destroying evidence. That's failure to provide evidence against yourself.
And in this case, I'm talking about the same thing. The failure to provide evidence against yourself in any case, there can be an innocent explanation for it, but we still allow that to come in, and we still allow that to be held against the person, as long as it doesn't violate any of their constitutionally protected rights. This case, it doesn't violate any of his constitutionally protected rights because his refusal to participate in a field sobriety test is not a constitutionally protected right.
You mean everybody in this courtroom can be arrested by a police officer who asks them to provide field sobriety tests if they refuse?
And if there are other indicators that they are intoxicated. I'm not going to say that just field sobriety tests by itself. I won't say that. But there are other indicators of intoxication in this case.
So essentially you're saying if the officer suspects you of driving while intoxicated for any reason, maybe you just pulled out of a bar parking lot, it's against the law not to participate in the field sobriety test because it can cause you to be arrested.
It's not against the law.
Well, it causes you to be arrested.
Pardon me?
It causes you to be arrested.
Well,
you are compelled to participate. You just finished saying you're required. Anytime a police officer asks you to participate, you're required to participate.
I won't say that anytime the officer requires you to. There has to be a reason to require those field sobriety tests.
And how does the citizen know when they're required to participate and when they're not?
Well, that's a question for the court to decide. That's not a question for the citizen to decide. And that's the same problem that we run into with every other case. Even if the defendant was not asked to provide field sobriety tests, the question of whether or not the person can refuse to allow himself to be taken into custody, that's a similar point, because the citizen is not charged with making that determination as to whether or not there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause to arrest the person. The citizen doesn't get to make that decision of whether or not there's probable cause. The officer makes that decision on the street, and then the court determines that.
There's
at a
an
later
offense
time.
Called resisting arrest. You cannot resist you cannot resist even an unlawful arrest.
That's true.
You can only protect yourself against unlawful force. So that's statutory.
Right. That is statutory. But the same principle applies, which is that the reasoning behind that statute, which is that the officer gets to make the determination on the street as to whether or not there's probable cause to arrest a person. That determination is then reviewed by a magistrate or by a court. And that decision is made by the court and by the officer on the street. It's not made by the citizen. The citizen is placed in a position where he is required to either cooperate with the officer, or if he refuses to cooperate with the officer, then the officer has certain inferences that he can take from that. And one of those inferences, a reasonable inference, is that the person is attempting to hide evidence of their intoxication. And because the officer can reasonably infer that the person is attempting to hide evidence of their intoxication, that's not just failing to provide, that's actually attempting to hide evidence. And so because the officer can make that reasonable inference, he can take that reasonable inference, he can combine it with other facts that he knows,